You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, May 22nd, 2026. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Aggressive U.S. foreign policy has created deep instability, not only here in Canada, but globally. From the ongoing war in Iran to a devastating four-month fuel blockade in Cuba causing medical blackouts and sanitation crises, the global impacts are severe. This week on Rabble Radio, we share a clip from the most recent off-the-hill political panel on American imperialism. This webinar took place on Tuesday, May 19th, and featured Gabrielle Desroches, Madeleine Drohan, Thomas Panay, and Carl Nirenberg. Here is a small clip from that conversation. Take a listen.
To start, I have a question for everyone. It's hard to know the goal or motivations for American foreign policy under Donald Trump, but what forces do you believe spark this new wave of foreign intervention? Thomas, let's start with you.
Thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me. Of course, there are numerous specific motivations for why they've been engaging in these foreign interventions, but there are at least three broad motivations. First, every new American administration comes in with the goal of wanting to preserve American hegemony. That is always the first goal. Second, part of the way of doing that is by making sure number two is kept on a leash. Of course, China doesn't want to be on a leash. So how do you deal with that? Well, Iran supplies 12% of China's oil. Venezuela supplies 5% of China's oil. If you control Iran and Venezuela, you have some leverage when you negotiate with China. And the U.S. and China, of course, have a number of meetings scheduled, along with the recent one. The third reason, of course, the obvious reason in a sense, is part of the reason the U.S. is the dominant power is that it preserves the interests of the capitalist system and the capitalist elite. So every intervention has some relationship back to that. It's normal that we focus on the state. Of course, the MAGA conservatives focus on the deep state, but we should never forget that which is deeper than the state. And that's, of course, the capitalist empire, the biggest empire of all. So I'll leave it at those three.
Thank you, Thomas. Madeleine, what are your thoughts about this new wave of foreign intervention by the U.S. and what's driving it?
Well, I think the U.S. has had a motivation from the very start about preserving its security. And that underlies a lot of its actions that, in fact, it sort of explains a lot of its actions. But it has been worried about its security from its very creation. Now, I know Trump overuses national security. Everything for him becomes a question of national security. But in some cases, security is the underlying factor for him. And I think what we're seeing is that the U.S. is changing its definition of what makes it feel secure. It used to be this global system that it had helped set up and led, and because it was leading it and everybody was doing basically what it wanted, it felt secure. But you've got a group in there now that doesn't believe in global institutions and are withdrawing back into the U.S., and so we're seeing different actions, but I think we have to look at them to, in the frame and the lens of, is the U.S. doing it to make itself feel more secure? And I think that's probably, that explains a lot of what it's doing.
Thank you very much, Madeleine. And Gabe, what's your perspective on this question?
Well, in so many ways, this is a really fascinating time to think about American imperialism, because on the one hand, of course, you know, when you set up the discussion, you pointed to some actions, some interventions that look very imperialist. On the other hand, the Republican base and the people who are, I mean, a lot of Trump's, frankly, is his sort of pitch on foreign policy to the American people was very anti-interventionist, right? It was very much about kind of withdrawing from its role in the world, because, you know, viewing this as the other countries get taking advantage of the United States. For us in, you know, in Canada, we would sort of laugh at that kind of characterization, but that certainly is a sincerely held belief of many of these people. And I think you kind of see a lot of tension around these interventionist actions that they're taking. You kind of have the sort of Marco Rubio kind of coded side of the Republican base that are maybe a little more in favor of an interventionist foreign policy. And then you have kind of the J.D. Vance side of things, which is very much an isolationist view of America's role in the world. And so, yeah, it's a very fascinating time to be talking about American imperialism, and also a fascinating time to look at the base of the Republicans, of the party in power, and the tension that is going to only get more strained over the next couple of years.
Thank you, Gabe. And Carl, this is a subject you've written about for Rabble since Trump returned to the presidency. What are your views on the change in U.S. foreign policy and, you know, the obvious overt belligerence of the Trump administration?
So, I mean, the United States has been really from the beginning an imperialist entity, although it claimed it did so under the guise of anti-imperialism, oddly. So, I mean, the United States originally was settled by settler colonialists from Europe, who cloaked their mission in a kind of mixture of commerce and a Christian pilgrimism. Even the use of the term pilgrims for the original settlers of the United States gave their mission some kind of holy character, some kind of greater mission, some kind of mission dictated by God and not merely by the necessity to find a safe haven. We turned it upside down now when we talk about these pilgrims originally settled in the United States as being victims of religious persecution who are seeking a safe place. But really, at the time, they were more seeking to expand the reach of Christian and white civilization. And from the beginning, it was the United States was imperialist or expansionist in that they expanded from the original territory, the original relatively small territory on the East Coast, through the entire 48 states and Alaska. And I mean, we know the story of the removals of vast numbers of indigenous people. They took huge whole peoples, whole groups of people whose homes were in places like Mississippi and Alabama and Florida, and they shipped them thousands of miles away into Oklahoma, Colorado, New Mexico, places like that. And just the other day on the radio, there was somebody doing a bit of a report saying he was going to go back to with his grandmother to the original tribal home of his people from Oklahoma to Mississippi. But the Americans, you know, without going on and on to the history, the United States has been an expansionist, an imperialist power from the outset of, you know, but again, it's odd. It's always phrased it just as Trump always portrays himself as the victim being unfairly treated, just as he's bullying everybody else. So they came up with the Monroe Doctrine, which is framed as protecting the integrity of the Western Hemisphere and of the nations of the Western Hemisphere, all of Latin America and the United States, against the predatory European imperialism, which, of course, in the 18th century was still a major and viable force. But the Monroe Doctrine then became the basis for continued ongoing American intervention in its own backyard. I mean, Woodrow Wilson, who was the great leader of, he skipped to the post-World War I era, who was the great liberator and the great inventor of the term self-determination, while he was engineering self-determination for the white and Christian former elements of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and some of the Turkish Empire, he was occupying Nicaragua and Haiti and Honduras and then the Philippines. So, I mean, the Americans frame their imperialist goal as being Christianizing, making the world safe for democracy, and preventing other empires from interfering in their sphere of influence. And of course, at some point it switched from being the empires of the old empires of Europe to being the threat, an imperialism that was framed as the communist threat at one time. And in a way, what's different now, and I'll end it there, is that Trump has, for the longest time, whoever was in charge of America wanted to give it some nobility to the American mission, that we never were saying we are building an American empire, or at least for the entire 20th century and the first part of the 21st century. You have to go back to the end of the 19th century to William McKinley, to be who was the last president who was proudly an imperialist and who used the term consciously, self-consciously, and openly, and said, we are building an American empire. And when he was greeted, there is a famous story of him being greeted in Buffalo by supporters shortly before he was assassinated. Welcome to our president and leader of our empire, William McKinley. No other president has used that rhetoric to describe himself since, until Trump. Trump, interestingly enough, Trump's two favorite presidents, his predecessors, whom he admires the most, are not Lincoln, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin Roosevelt, Eisenhower, not even Reagan. His two role models are both significant imperialist figures of their era, Andrew Jackson of the Indian Wars, so-called, and William McKinley. And he is deliberately now, he wants to, in the style of McKinley, expand the territory of the United States. So for Canadians, it's a scary kind of imperialism, because Trump is open about that, and Trump has an ambition to see one country that includes not just the current lower 48 and Alaska, but also all of Canada and Greenland. He wants, mm-hmm. because he wants that, then the United States will be territorially the largest country in the world. It won't be in population, it won't, but its population will increase by a relatively marginal amount. But that is the Trump's ambition. It's very different from a president, even Lyndon Johnson or right. Eisenhower, who said we're defending ourselves against the intrusion of communists, and we are defending ourselves against other empires and other powers, and we're protecting our security. So I think there's a qualitative difference now. We're headed towards a very old-fashioned concept of empire that goes back to the Romans and Napoleon and to William McKinley.
All right. Thank you very much, Carl. Gabby, I think you had the next question.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carl. You've put this moment into some really interesting perspective. And so the next question, I'm going to hand it over to Thomas now. How are the imperialist actions, like the military intervention, America's military intervention in Iran, reshaping global perceptions of the country? How is this affecting the American empire now?
Let me just add a few points in terms of what Carl said, because I thought I agree completely with Carl's point here. What's interesting about the U.S. is that it sees itself as having broken from the British Empire, as having helped dismantle the British Empire after World War II, as having defeated the Nazi Empire, and as having caused the collapse of the Soviet Empire. So this is part of its kind of anti-imperial self-conception. At the same time, it has a network of 750 military bases around the world. Its military spending is greater than the next nine spenders combined. You add up China, Russia, India, South Korea, Japan, England, Germany, France, it is still less than what the U.S. is spending. The U.S. is always ready for intervention. So this is the weird contradiction you get in the U.S. On one hand, anti-imperial. On the other hand, always ready for intervention. In terms of, I mean, I think one thing also to point out is you'll note that for the last 75 years, people are always going on about the U.S. being in decline. Whenever there's an economic crisis, like the 1973 OPEC oil crisis or the 2008 financial crisis, or whenever there's a military crisis, 1951 Korea, 1974 Vietnam, 2003 Iraq, 2021 Afghanistan, and of course now 2026 Iran, you start getting the declinist narrative. It just keeps coming back. The problem is, for the last 50 years, the U.S. consistently produces 20 to 25% of global GDP. One country out of 200 countries has an incredible amount of economic productivity. I mean, it would be like, for anyone who's following the Montreal Canadiens, if Cole Caulfield scored 20% of the Canadiens' goals for the next 50 years, he would be a hockey god. I mean, this is the U.S. position over the last 50 years. And so you can never underestimate the U.S.'s ability to reinvent itself and reemerge from a crisis stronger than ever.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And for those of you in the chat, I believe we dropped in a link to a recent episode of Rabble Radio that we did with Thomas, where he goes even more into depth on this issue. Gabe, my next question is to you, and it's about middle powers. Like Canada. We heard in Davos, Mark Carney lay out what he said was a vision for middle powers. He's been criticized for maybe not quite sticking to that vision. But what are your thoughts? How can middle powers like Canada exist in a world of this new U.S. imperialism?
Well, you brought up Davos, so maybe I can quote a line from Prime Minister Carney, Carney's Davos speech. He said, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And that, I think, is one sort of prescription. And a big piece of that is the concept of coalitions, being at the table and building your own coalition. So I'm a public opinion researcher, and some numbers that have stuck out to me over the past few months are some numbers around Canadians' appetite to get more involved with the European Union, right? 75% of Canadians are interested in closer cooperation with the EU. Nearly half, 48%, actually support Canada joining the EU as a member state. So that idea of being at the table has, you know, in a very formal way, as part of a coalition that is not as U.S. Dependent, is popular in Canada. So on the one hand, Canadians are interested in following Prime Minister Carney's path of new coalitions, and the second half of that is how middle powers can adapt to the new sort of chaotic order is developing our own sovereign capacity, right? So particularly in defense, in energy, so much of the discussion about our kind of sovereign capacity and energy is focused on pipelines and fossil fuels, but the world is moving toward a clean energy transition, and Canada happens to be resource rich. In a lot of components that are very, very important to the clean energy transition. So I'd like to see a bit more of a focus there from this government. But on things like food and tech, I mean, one of my current obsessions is like the American dominance in AI, second only to China. So there's a need, or sorry, not second only. China is in a quite distant second from the U.S.'s position of dominance. So there is a need formidable powers like Canada to develop some sovereign capacity. We are probably hopeless in competing with the United States on things like kind of compute power that you need for real sovereign AI capacity, but certainly on defense, on energy, especially clean energy, and technology investments in that sovereign capacity are essential, and there is public support for that. So yeah, coalitions, investments in sovereign capacity, those I think would be the two key ways that Canadians themselves see the country setting up a bulwark.
Thank you so much, Gabe. I think that sets out an interesting perspective for us here in Canada. I wanted to pass the next question on to Madeline. We know there are many progressives, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who oppose America's new military imperialism in America. So how can America's progressives strategically turn the tide against things like the Monroe Doctrine and America's new military aggression? And I guess additionally, how can us in Canada, people like us in Canada, support those efforts?
Those are big questions. I think in Canada, we are uniquely unprepared or have been uniquely unprepared for this latest turn in American foreign policy because we were lulled into complacency, I think, through this post-Second World War era of friendly relations. And I don't know how many people you hear quote all the time, you know, the John Kennedy quote about history made us neighbors or geography. I can't remember the exact quote, but the idea is that we're supposedly friends. And I think a lot of Canadians sort of swallowed that idea that we were friends with the Americans when we might be friends on an individual level, but countries don't have friends, they have interests. But all of which is to say when American imperialism reemerged, because it wasn't just created with Trump, he's just picking up on something that's been below the surface, we weren't ready to respond either on a personal level or on a national level as well. We've been scrambling ever since. So that's just to talk about Canadians. How could they help progressives in the U.S.? I'm not sure.
That was a small snippet of our latest Off the Hill panel. To watch the entire panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's hand things back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Back to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with provincial news. The government of Alberta Premier Danielle Smith continues to try and find a way to have a referendum on separation from Canada this fall. This comes after a federal judge ruled that a petition calling for such a referendum was unconstitutional because it did not consult First Nations. A committee of the Alberta Legislature voted this week that a referendum should go forward anyway. The announcement of the committee vote results was released to the public prior to the vote taking place. Commentator David Kleimenhage said that this is an example of Daniel Smith's desire to force a referendum on the issue and sideline the correct political process. Meanwhile, it was reported this week that the database of voter information leaked to the public by a pro-separatist group in Alberta was created with the help of individuals connected to U.S. Ambassador to Canada Peter Hoekstra and others connected to the Trump administration. Also this week, Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagin shares an op-ed about parents and sleep training for babies. She argues that countries like Denmark, which are banning the practice of allowing babies to cry themselves to sleep, are putting the well-being of parents, and especially mothers, at risk. Parents are often sleep-deprived as it is with a newborn baby, and this can be compounded for some people who can get pregnant who may experience health issues after birth, like postpartum depression. Instead of banning the practice of babies crying themselves to sleep, governments instead should offer programs where nurses can come and provide supportive child care for parents. In labor news this week, rising gas prices mean that Canadians will collectively be spending $12 billion more this year. This is because of the attack on Iran by the U.S. and Israel, which led to the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Nearly 20 million barrels of oil a day passed through the strait in 2025. Due to the world's reliance on fossil fuels, higher oil prices leads to higher prices for almost all goods, from construction materials like asphalt to groceries on store shelves. Economists like Jim Stanford, however, are pointing out that for an oil-exporting nation like Canada, higher oil prices are not a result of market forces, but a result of governments and corporations allowing for higher prices. In a report for the Center for Future Work, Stanford writes, quote, "Prices for petroleum products have not shot up because of natural market forces. Events in the Persian Gulf are dramatically affecting our economy because of a policy choice, not laws of economic nature," end quote. Also this week, Rabble reviews a new book on the rise of Bernie Sanders. Bernie for Burlington chronicles the rise of the popular left-wing politician from his days as mayor of Burlington, Vermont. The book's author, Dan Chiasson, grew up in Burlington in the 1980s while Sanders was mayor and witnessed his formative years as a politician. Chiasson notes that at that time, it was clear that Sanders already had a progressive and populist bent to his politics. Growing up in poverty in New York and Chicago, Sanders always maintained a strong desire to ensure that the rich paid their fair share and that there was a strong social safety net to catch those who had fallen on hard times. Read Tom Sanborn's review of Bernie for Burlington on Rabble.ca today. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is arguing for a circular approach when it comes to housing strategy. Suzuki points out that when a home is demolished, much of the wood, stone, plastic, and metal that was in the home goes to the landfill. All of those materials can be recycled. A Vancouver-based think tank, Lighthouse, estimates that about 20% of demolished homes in that city could have been moved, and another 60% could have been deconstructed, with materials reused or recycled. Municipalities across the country are facing a crisis when it comes to housing construction. A circular approach to housing could help relieve some of that pressure. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick, and that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. Thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music to this show. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you.